This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome, everyone, to this special interview edition of Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross, and today's episode is a conversation with Noah Eagle. He is in his first year as the play-by-play voice for NBC's Roland Garros coverage. You'll hear him on both the women's and the men's singles finals on NBC this weekend. You've also seen him on Tennis Channel for this event and over the years. Also, the play-by-play voice of NBC's Big Ten primetime college football. He'll be doing basketball for their coverage of the Paris Olympics coming up, NFL on Nickelodeon, and a whole lot more. We get into the upcoming Iga Swiatek versus Jasmine Paolini final. We hit on Alcaraz and Sinner semifinal coming up tomorrow. Novak Djokovic storylines as it pertains to this year's Roland Garros. What it's like to work in a booth with John McEnroe and Mary Carrillo. And some other more tennis broadcasting related topics towards the end of our conversation, which was awesome. Noah and I go way back to our time at Syracuse University, working together at the student radio station, the student TV station, and all of that. And I've been lucky enough to call him a friend over the years. So it was great to have him on. I do want to, and I'm going to go quickly because we did have a long chat, Noah and I. But I want to talk a little bit about the women's semifinals that we watched today. First off, Iga Swiatek beats Coco Gauff again, head-to-head now 11-1 for Iga. We've seen Coco Gauff try to make adjustments and try a lot of different things over the course of this head-to-head. But this was probably the most radical tennis she has ever played against Swiatek. It was like she was trying to do an impersonation of Naomi Osaka or Elena Rybakina or Aryna Sabalenka, just trying to really redline her forehand aggression or her aggression as a whole, suffocate Iga and try to play as much offensive tennis as possible. And at the end of the day, that's what a 10-1 head-to-head does. Was Gauff's forehand up to the task? No, it wasn't. For all of the added aggression that Gauff tried to inject into her game, she very much paid the price by way of unforced errors. Was it the best performance of Coco's career? No. But for me, it's really tough to criticize her because the worst thing you can do in this matchup, and mind you, we've seen a lot of players get dominated in a head-to-head and just keep trotting out there doing the same exact thing and hoping it's their day or hoping something changes. And Coco's not doing that. She's finding a new way to lose. And if you're finding a new way to lose, that's a whole lot better than doing the same thing over and over again. For Iga, I continue to think that she's handling that style of play better and better, where she used to come up against a level of hyper-aggression and feel the need to counter with her own hyper-aggression. It's often been said that your Yelena Ostapenko, Elena Rybakina, Danielle Collins, Linda Neskova at the Australian Open, it's often been said that those players have taken the racket out of Iga Swiatek's hands. I get where that comes from. I slightly disagree. I think Iga in some of those matches has taken the racket out of her own hands by being so uncomfortable being dictated to that she herself looks to respond with her own level of aggression that leads to her own erratic play. I don't think Swiatek was all that steady in those matchups on a consistent basis. And man, last few months or so, every time she comes up against one of these players, I feel like she's accepting the role in these matches of, okay, if I just stay solid against these hyper-aggressive players and I use my movement and I use my defense and I do try to put them under pressure with my weight of shot and my depth, they will miss for me. And I can win these matches on a more consistent basis via an easier scoreline by actually just keeping the game super clean. That's what she did against Coco today. She didn't respond to Coco's aggressiveness by trying to one-up her own aggressiveness. She stayed within herself and she let Coco miss. And that was really good by Iga. I also continue to notice her serve, which I know I talked about after she beat Sabalenka in Madrid. And I talked about after she beat Osaka in the second round here. But the numbers are in, okay? They are in. And Swiatek averaged 102 miles per hour on her serve through the course of Roland Garros 2023, which of course she won. This year, she's averaging 111. Absolutely enormous leap. And you're seeing the results. You're seeing how many more unreturned serves she's getting. Oftentimes, not even having to hit her spot. She might go to the body, and she still gets these unreturned serves. That's what 10 miles per hour extra, in this case 9, that's what that does for you. And for Iga to already be the best player in the world, and then to continue to add to her weaponry, or build up her weaponry, bolster it, that's scary for the field. Second semifinal, Jasmine Paolini versus Mira Andreeva. Not much needs to be said. Andreeva, overwhelmed, not quite ready for that, extremely young, and she will start to get more used to those stages, and she'll play better when she gets back there, which I'm pretty sure she will, based on her talent level. We'll talk more about Jasmine Paolini, Noah and I, in our conversation. So let's jump right to that. Let's talk about this women's final, because you just got done calling the semis, and now it's kind of about selling this final. Do you ever think about it that way? Like, coming into a match, is there a part of you that says, okay, how do we sell this? How do we make this matter the most to people who may not know why it matters, other than the fact that it's a French Open final?
Yeah, I think somewhat. I think certainly there's a massive difference when I'm calling a match or hosting on Tennis Channel versus when you're doing it on NBC. Just because you know your audience is vastly different. I think Tennis Channel, you're going to have a large percentage that are in the know tennis fans. And so you have to treat it as such because you don't want to talk down to your audience. Versus on NBC, especially for the finals, you're going to have a larger percentage of that audience that maybe just tunes in and hasn't watched a single match all year, or maybe only tunes in for the Grand Slams. And in that case, you've got to make sure that you're educating them the right way. You don't want to oversell, but you also don't want to undersell. So you want to find that happy medium. I think finals do that in their own right. But especially one like this, where you've got a tournament that doesn't have Rafa Nadal in it on the men's side, a tournament that doesn't, for a lot of the casual fans, let's call it, have the Williams sisters or anybody of that stature outside the tennis world yet. And Iga Swiatek is certainly on her way to becoming that, especially if she can win yet another title here. But you don't have that necessarily. So I think that for us, we rely a lot on the storytelling aspect, getting into the backgrounds of the players, getting into the quotes and a lot of what they've said over the course of the tournament. And then I would say I'm really lucky because I have two analysts with me that see the game in such an incredible way. I mean, John McEnroe's a tennis genius, has been his whole life. And even now, in terms of just seeing action in the moment and recognizing situations and recognizing what players should do, especially during breaks, you know, he'll say something that's just genius. And you know that it's coming directly from the coach's box as well. And Mary Carrillo, I mean, there's nobody more prepared in that role, in that seat. So to have them next to me, I let them handle a lot of the nitty gritty of the actual tennis. And then I can focus on kind of the overarching storyline. So they make my life real easy. And doing the final, I would say it's pretty much the same, but it'll be a little different because you've got, at least in this matchup, two completely opposite storylines, in my opinion. You've got a dominant figure on one and another one that has taken until her 28th, you know, year 28 in the world and decade plus on tour to break through like this, and has kind of come out of nowhere in many senses in a Grand Slam. So it'll be cool. I think it's an intriguing final.
Yeah, I guess part of the impetus for asking that is it's not a match that anybody is going to expect Paulina to win.
No doubt.
Just not. Nobody other than maybe hopefully Jasmine herself thinks she has a pretty good chance, and the people close to her hopefully think she has a pretty good chance. But other than that, Iga's dominance is the prevailing story, I suppose. And you need to, I guess, learn to appreciate dominance, which we've had a lot of practice doing with Rafa. Not to say that it's never been said that Nadal's dominance at RG is boring in some way or got dull in some way. At the same time, especially in the latter years, just because there isn't an enormous amount of suspense for who's going to win doesn't mean that it can't be something that can be appreciated.
I also think that for Iga to have a Grand Slam in which she saved a match point adds even more to her lore that she's built up. I think, to your point, having a new clay court figure that can exude this level of dominance is interesting for the sport, because now every year, everyone's gunning for that position. Everyone's gunning for that player. And that was Rafa for basically 20 years. You know, he wins 14 of them and he barely ever loses in the tournament, let alone, forget, this was the first time he lost in the first round, obviously. But when we were doing that match, some of the stats that I found were legitimately laughable. I mean, we were laughing about them on the air. He was that dominant. Iga hasn't reached that level of dominance, even at Roland Garros. And she's been incredible. Has the second best match record through 35 matches at this tournament, only behind Evert, which basically everybody is. But even Chrissy was texting Mary tonight as we were doing the Iga match. And even she said that Iga's better than she was on the clay, or she believes that at least. She believes that she's a better all-around player in a different era with stiffer competition and different styles of play that she has to play against. And she might be right. I mean, it's hard to argue with someone who's won the tournament 7 times. But if Iga wins it a 4th time at 23 years old, I mean, she's well on her way to potentially toppling that mark herself. So I do think to be a part of this journey in any way is still special and still cool, and to appreciate in the moment. And I'm sure that that's probably what a lot of tennis fans really took from this year with Rafa, is you almost take it for granted when it's happening. You just say, oh my God, this is all right. He's just unbelievable. He's a different level. But to actually take the step back and understand what's happening in front of us, I think that's what it's given us, is that perspective. So it'll be cool to see if she can finish the job, which, again, everyone expects her. But it's an awesome story for Jasmine Paolini to win a 1,000 event this year, to break into the top 10, to do all that she has, and to do it in the manner that she has, you know, and the exuberance that she brings to the court, the constant smile on her face, the energy. It's infectious. And so, and combine that with the Italian tennis story, which I think is really cool. Everyone wants to talk about the Italian man. And now here comes Paolini at 28 years old, breaking into the top 10 and into her first Grand Slam final. So a lot to be had, not to mention the double side, where you've got a men's doubles final that's going to have Italians in it. You've got now a guaranteed women's singles final that'll have an Italian in it. You could have a men's single final that has an Italian in it. And I didn't even check to see if Paolini and Errani took the court for their semifinal, but they could be in the final of the women's doubles as well. So that's pretty cool.
Wimbledon 09 was the first time you had the same country in all 4 finals, with Roddick, of course, in the men's singles. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Iga is on, and people get really nervous about saying these kinds of things, but the stats are right there. She's not like off of a Rafa Nadal pace. She's on that pace. She's on that trajectory. That's not to say she's going to win 14, but it is to say she has not eliminated herself from the 14 conversation.
Yeah, that's fair. I would say I haven't eliminated myself from dating Margot Robbie. Like, we can go through so many possibilities of things that are still in the realm, but you're right. It's obviously a lot more realistic for her, and what she's done, I mean, is incredible. You know, it just feels like I think Osaka gave us the blueprint of what it takes to beat her, and Osaka played the best we've ever seen on clay and still didn't. I know you've talked about the Rome final, and Sabalenka played as well as you've probably seen her on clay, still couldn't beat her. That, to me, is the mark of when you talk about Rafa, right? You get not just an average player's greatest punch, but you get the players that are directly with you in ranking and in stats and everything else. You get their best punches. You get Grand Slam winners' best punches. And still, even maybe when you're not at your best, you're still finding ways to win. That, to me, is a mark of being a step above on a surface. And that's what she is. And like, even today against Coco, and Coco didn't play her best, not even close. But it's not like Coco just completely imploded. It was a lot of Iga just completely being more solid in every sense of the game, it felt like, every step of the way. She didn't overpower her. She's not going to do that necessarily, but she took her time away and just made her so uncomfortable, which, think about how difficult that is to do on clay. And it's kind of what Rafa, especially as his career went on later in his career, like early, he was just so relentless. He was going to get to every single ball. He was going to play every point, balls to the wall. That's awesome. But it felt like later in his career, as he developed more and he really especially developed his net game and his willingness to come in, like, it just made him that much more dangerous. And I just feel like that's kind of what Iga is. And she's only going to continue to evolve. So it's cool to watch this trajectory. And to your point, it's just the beginning of what's going to be a long slope up.
Yeah. And in fairness, most people have eliminated themselves from the 14 conversation at 23 years old. Usually it's too late.
That's like, very, very true.
You're 23. Like, it's over. Like, 14 is not happening, but yeah. You know, I think what was so impressive to think about is you have Coco, who's going to be world number two, feeling the need to completely change her game because she's playing Iga. And usually world number twos are like, no, I'm good enough. I'm going to play my game. And then that's going to be enough. But Coco, rightly so, with the head to head, she can't even feel that way. So,
well, and that's what stuck out to me, is how far she was inside of her own head because of the 10-1 tally leading up to the match, now 11-1 in the head-to-head. And I would have to look back again. I think five of those are now on clay. So it's not like all of those are on clay and her hard court record is still fine. Iga still dominates her on hard court. So even in Coco's realm and Coco's world, it feels like Iga has the upper hand. And we saw that, you know, we were doing the match of Hubie Hurkacz and Grigor Dimitrov. And I was surprised to see the head-to-head record in favor of Grigor, and Hubie hadn't taken a single match. In fact, he literally had never won a tiebreak against him, which, for a guy with a serve at that level, and not to say that Grigor is a slouch in that department, but for a guy who serves at the level that Hubie does, to not take a single tiebreak, and they played several of them, that was shocking to me. But you could see how deep in his own head Hubie was, to the point of, like, that's a guy that doesn't show a lot of emotion on the court. And for anybody who watched that match, I've never seen him kind of outpour the way he did and self-destruct emotionally the way that he did, and lose his mind over chair umpires and trying to change the mid-match. Like, I've never seen that from him. He's usually so even keeled and just quiet to himself, go, you know, business-like, workman-like. He wasn't like that. And I think we saw that from Coco when there was the one serve call that went awry and she goes up to the chair umpire and rightfully makes her argument. She was correct. But then to let tears out in the middle of the match, for someone who is known for her mental toughness and mental fortitude that we've seen now, especially that's even grown from when she was the young phenom that she was, where that was already a strength of hers, that's grown and grown and grown. And especially since Brad has helped take over, it feels like that was her letting out all the frustrations in the head-to-head. And to your point, she tried to change her game a little too much and it cost her.
Yeah, the mental toughness. It's one of her best qualities, objectively. One more on the women's final. What do you find most interesting about Jasmine Paolini? Because she is somebody who won't be as familiar, going back to the difference in the viewerships. Maybe the Tennis Channel viewership base knows Jasmine Paolini quite well. NBC might not be familiar with her, especially because she hadn't made it to a slam quarterfinal before this event. She is kind of a veteran, but she's had this breakthrough, not completely out of nowhere, because as you mentioned, she's a Masters 1000 champion this year. What is most intriguing about her to you?
There's a lot. I mean, as someone who's part of the vertically challenged community, you know, I think we feel a sense of pride for someone who's 5'4" doing the things that she's doing and gritty, you know, clearly a gritty style, but the forehand is still pretty big for someone her size. And I think that's what was so, because I hadn't really seen a lot of her in person. You know, I'd done matches maybe on Tennis Channel when I was in Los Angeles and Santa Monica, and you see it, but it doesn't really do it justice until you see it up close and see it with your own eyes. And so to see how big her forehand can get, how much topspin she can generate, pretty impressive at her size, how she can overcome not just a, you know, a lackluster serve, but I would say a poor serve. I mean, she was today, right? And she, I don't think she got broken today. She was getting broken 4 times per match leading into this semifinal. And she's playing someone who's not afraid to let it rip. And it cost Andreeva when it was all said and done. And she had too many unforced errors pile up. But Paolini's first serve was probably averaging about 100 miles per hour. And her second serve was pretty consistently in the 70s. And so to have a second serve on clay that's in the 70s and have someone who's willing to take chances that could not find a way to take advantage of it. Now, I will say I'm not expecting Iga not to take advantage of that. But that to me was impressive and certainly surprising. And then she came when I was hosting on Tennis Channel. She came over and chatted with Prakash and I, and her humility stands out immediately. Her graciousness and legitimate, I would say, feel of thankfulness for where she is and how she's gotten there and the journey she's been on really stands out, which I think is really cool because you don't always get that. And then the last thing I'll say is, she's very honest about where she was, why she hasn't gotten to where she has been now this year, and kind of everything in between. And Prakash asked her about the mental aspect and factor. And look, we know it. And you talk about it all the time. The best way to build confidence is results. And she's gotten results this year. That's one thing. But she also has said that she actually legitimately didn't believe she belonged with those top players earlier in her career. Despite maybe making the top 100, she still felt like there's a gap between us. And then she took a small step and still felt like there was a gap. And so now she's gotten to this point where she feels like she's done all the steps necessary. And because of that, she's at the level that she can beat anybody on any given day. And she's proven that now the last couple of rounds.
Yeah, I think from her demeanor, you know, she seems so happy to be there. She's smiling all the time, kind of the Alcaraz effect. It's a great way to get people to like you. Just smile a lot. And, you know, the game, you led with the forehand, which I love. Not going to lie, I've watched her play, and there have been people who have commented in some platform or another that, oh, she's a grinder, right? Because you see, here's someone who has most of her results on clay. Here's someone who's 5'4". Here's someone from Italy where they grow up on clay. And you're like, oh, here's a grinder. And then that's the tell, oh, you haven't actually really watched Paolini play carefully. And that's what the initial assumption is. And then she proves you wrong. Because no, she hits the crap out of the ball. Now, she also flies around the court. So that speed to power ratio is really fun to watch. And yeah, she's someone who easy for me to get behind her. So I know, you know, it's not the blockbuster of Rybakina or Sabalenka in this final, but it is someone who I enjoy watching immensely. And I think the more people get to know her, the more others will be in alignment with that.
Yeah. And I'm going to go back again. I do think that the Italian tennis thing is good. I think that it's been way too long. And look, we had Schiavone and Irani and a couple others on the women's side. The men, it's been a long, long time coming. But I just feel like overall, it's been a long time coming for Italian tennis to be like this, to win Davis Cup last year, to have the results they did, to have Sinner now be world number one, and to have Paolini at 28 years old kind of take the torch. You know, you had Trevisan a couple years ago make a semifinal. I do think that's a good thing for the sport and the growth of the sport and the continued globalization to the level that it deserves to be. So I think that aspect is good as well, but you're 100% right. And I'm excited to see, because look, if you're going to beat Iga Swiatek, especially on this surface, you better find a way to hit through her essentially. I mean, that's what Osaka did. That's what, if Sabalenka is going to beat her, she does, or when Rybakina has beaten her, that's what she does. Like you need a big hitter. And at least on that forehand side, you know that she, that Paolini's going to, she's going to go for it. She's not going to hold back. I know. I think she knows the game plan. I also think, and this is probably the best thing you can have for someone playing Iga on the surface, she knows she has nothing to lose at this point. You know, she's going to be in the top 10. I think after the win today, she's 7 in the live rankings. So she's going to be in the top 10, highest ranking of her career. She's made it to a major final. She's going to make a ton of money from this, obviously. There's so many aspects of, hey, I've already done this, so why not just let it rip and go for it? I think that's what you need against Iga in a final versus maybe some of the others that would have been a little bit more measured and would have been a little bit more tactical. She's just going to go out and give it her all.
Let's go to the men because that's Saturday. Should be on Tech Paolini. What time?
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Noah?
9 a.m. Eastern on NBC.
Okay. Thank you for that. I knew you'd be ready for that. That fastball of a question.
Listen, man, come on. You know I'm an amoeba out here. I adjust to my surroundings.
Yes. Okay, Alcaraz Sinner. I mean, do you want to tell the story, the origins? Because, you know, those two players have meant a lot to us through the years as we've discussed tennis, you know, off the mic, so to speak.
Yeah. So in 2020, when COVID was still very rampant, but if you remember the return tours, so to speak, and there were a lot of exhibitions around, one of which was Novak Djokovic's Adria Tour, which I did call, and Lindsay Davenport and I actually just were reminiscing about it a couple of days ago, and we showed up. We obviously weren't in Belgrade, but we showed up to Tennis Channel, and we sat down, and the two of us were like, can we, you know, shake hands or bump fists, or are we allowed to take the masks off? Because at this point it's June or July of 2020 and there's a lot going on. And then we turn on the screens and see shirtless fans and shirtless Novak and Grigor doing whatever he was doing. And we're like, what's going on here? So that was the start of it. And I think a couple weeks after that, I want to say it was Tommy Haas put together an exhibition in Germany. And it was, I remember Tommy Haas played. This was, you know, 42-year-old Haas, who was still in excellent shape, couldn't play a five-setter, but he could play a couple nice sets and give you a nice show. It was Zverev, who at that point was getting ready to eventually make his run to the final at the US Open. maybe Medvedev. I can't remember who the other was, but Sinner was the fourth, and Sinner was new to the scene. And at that point, he might have been 17 years old. And this was before he made his run at Roland Garros that year. And he was still, you know, he was, I think he had won maybe ATP Newcomer of the Year or something. So he was starting to make noise. But I called two or three of his matches in that exhibition along with Paul Anacone. And I turned to Paul after, I think, the second one. And I was like, this kid's unbelievable. And he goes, he's pretty good, right? I go, like, I think this kid could be number one day. And Paul was like, he'll be top five for sure, top five. So I call you, Gil, and I was like, this dude, Jannik Sinner, man, I think he's going to be number one. Now, keep in mind, everybody listening, this was 2020, again, before his Roland Garros run. And Gil, because Gil is plugged in and very well educated, said, I think this kid's really, really good, but you got to look at this other kid named Carlos Alcaraz from Spain, who's like 16. He's going to be number one. And I was like, I'll take Sinner. And Gil said, I'll take Alcaraz. And from here, it's been history from there. So I've been riding with Sinner. Gil's been riding with Alcaraz. As of Wimbledon last year, I thought my chances were completely done. And then Gil called me after the Australian Open and said, you're not out of this yet. So we've got a nice little friendly back and forth.
I'll tell you, there have been twists and turns. I mean, this has been an exciting horse race. I mean, you have Sinner a little bit ahead of schedule, a couple of years older. Then you have Alcaraz with the meteoric rise, but Sinner doing really well against him head to head, relatively, right? It is 4-4 as we go into this semifinal. But, you know, Alcaraz was doing better against the field until the last 8 months. Jannik's on a tear. I feel like at the moment, objectively, I think it's like basically even. Like if you told me Sinner has the better career, Alcaraz has the better career, I do have a slight lean in my head, but I feel like it could totally go either way right now.
I agree. And I think I'm not going out on a limb by saying that this is the next great tennis rivalry as a result, which means that Gil and I have the next great tennis rivalry to ourselves. But I do think that it's great for the sport, first and foremost. Secondly, okay, why don't we, if we just break down why each of them would potentially have a better career. Right now, Carlitos has the more complete all-around game. He's got every possible tool in the toolbox. His net game, I mean, McEnroe says he might be the best volleyer on tour right now, and it's hard to disagree with him. I mean, he's a magician at the net. His movement around the court is still elite. I'm not sure. It's hard-pressed outside of maybe Monfils or someone like that to find a better athlete on the tennis court. Just movement alone. Like, it's some of the way, and it's not even, I'm trying to describe it. It's like the way he moves his body around the court. And again, you do it more justice when you see it up close. And I know you saw it at the US Open, where I think he's even more impressive as a mover, because he can still somehow slide just enough or just the right amount on a hard court as much as he can on clay. And then the fact that, and you talk about being ahead of schedule for him, the fact that he could win Wimbledon last year when he's not supposed to be able to know how to play that level on grass, and not just win it, but beat Novak in a final of epic proportions, was incredible. So in terms of just overall skill and like raw natural talent, you probably give it to Alcaraz. But the mental side of it, Sinner is unflappable in so many ways. I mean, it up until that quarantine, and I do want to get into the last name of this player real quick, just as an aside.
Sure. We can talk about that.
Because like 70% of people are saying Mute, and then you go and listen to his ATP, you know, little click the sound thing, and he'll tell you how to say it. And he says quarantine Mutet, which is how, yeah, I think he did too, because I think he likes to troll. But at the same time, if you're going to do that, I'm going to say Mutet, because I'm going to then punish you for trolling. Like, that's my mentality. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, you know, he's been asked about this. Somebody did address this with him, and his response, it's borderline insulting. He basically said that he was tired of people mispronouncing his name. So, which is not hard to say. I mean, I'd like to think we're professionals. You don't even need to be a professional. Okay. This is not Annalena Kalinina. Okay. This is Mute. It's not that difficult. And, yeah, he lied. He lied on his ATP little bug thingy. So,
all right.
So what would be the decision, Noah? Like, next time. And I know Johnny Mack also has to weigh in on the pronunciation. Very important.
He does like to weigh in a lot.
He needs to be on board. So
we did have Malfis against Tiago Zybach-Wielsch, which was a fun one with John, because literally as we were doing whatever match was on before them, they said, all right, promo the night match. I said, hey, you can go here and get Gael Monfils against Tiago Zybach-Wielsch. And he goes, how'd you say that? While we were on the air. And I said, Tiago Zybach-Wielsch. He goes, are you sure it's not Saboth Wild? I go, I'm sure. Yes, I'm sure it's not Saboth Wild. He goes, all right, we'll check in the break. I'm like, this is all on. And so we have Greg Sharko, who is a legend within the ATP world, with us in the booth. And we go to break. He goes, it's Zybach-Wielsch. Yeah, it's Zybach-Wielsch. And then he got it like 98%. He was calling him Zybach-Wielsch some of the time, but I give him credit. He's been a lot better on the pronunciation side. But yes, the I'm going to call Quarantine Moutet the liar from now on. So other than the match with the liar, Yannick Sinner's mental and most specifically his ability to hold off break points is something that I think every player on tour would envy. I think every player on tour would look at and say, if only I could be like that in the big points, then I'd be number one in the world too. You know, I think that's where I still like Yannick a little bit more, because the highs aren't too high and the lows aren't too low. And then you combine that with the improvements on the serve, you combine that with a natural forehand whipping ability and his own movement on the court, especially on clay right now, where I know we were texting about it, you know, the skiing background clearly comes into play. It's impossible to choose between the two. It really is. And so I think that we get to just sit back and enjoy what hopefully is this incredible rivalry for many years to come.
Yeah, I love that assessment. And obviously my viewers and listeners get to hear me weigh in on this bi-weekly. So I won't make my response too long, but I would almost boil it down to, does Alcaraz have 10% more magic in him? Yes, absolutely. But Sinner has 10% more reliability in him. And I think that's kind of the fascinating dynamic that plays out. So we'll see what happens. I want to move to Djokovic. Here's my question for you. Are you more optimistic about, and this is also relevant because of the Olympics, which is also NBC property. You'll be doing men's basketball, for anyone curious. Men's only, right? Do you do women's as well?
Men's and women's.
Oh, men's and women's. Okay. So you'll be on the hoops. But for Djokovic, the Olympics is, you know, means a ton. It's the one hole in the resume, the Olympic gold. Are you more or less optimistic about Novak's 2024 after this event?
I mean, I think it's impossible not to say you're more optimistic, because the level of pessimism going into RG this year for him was probably at an all-time high since early in his career when he couldn't stop cramping. So, I mean, we're talking about 15 years, maybe more actually, 18 years since this level of pessimism really following Djokovic, or maybe the vaccination stuff, I guess, but that was out of his control and other than him getting the shot, I guess. But that's a separate and completely different discussion that we have no reason to get into right now. In terms of level of play and capability of playing at that same high level, way more optimistic after seeing him. But in terms of now health, he's just coming off of surgery now, so he's got knee surgery. I don't know how long it's going to take him to recover and recover fully. And if you're talking about like getting back for the Olympics, I don't know I could see him. Like, I could see him getting on the court maybe, but can you see him playing at a high level on the court? Probably not, especially a court that he needs to move the way you would have to on the clay. I think it's more realistic to hope that he would be ready to go at a good enough level to make a little bit of a run in New York, but even that feels a little soon. So if we're just talking about overall on the season, on the 2024 calendar year, I'm probably a little bit more down just because of the health side. But if we were talking about just sheer level and knowing that he still has that in him, I'm way more optimistic now than I was, especially after everything that went down in Geneva. Like, it felt like he went there and the sky was falling. I mean, the way that he lost and then he basically blamed his stomach. I was like, what's going on with this dude? It felt like, and not to mention, that's on top of everything he's done with his team all year and his coaching situation, the carousel there, which generally would tell you a player is searching for something. And he definitely felt like he was searching for something. This is, we're talking about a guy who usually is so mentally airtight in that world, especially, and especially when he's ruling the tennis world, which for 2024, he had it. So just because of the injury, I'll say I'm probably more down, but if it weren't for the injury, and even let's say he would have lost to Rude or to Zverev in the quarters and the semis and didn't get to the final, which I have no idea if that would have happened because he was playing at a pretty high level. But let's say that happened. Let's say he gets past Cirundolo, he loses to Rude in the quarters. I still think I probably would have felt better about him just because I saw that level was still in him. And then it was about sustainability and really more than anything, motivation, because it felt like he almost needed to motivate himself in that Musetti match and then needed to motivate himself through the injury in the Cirundolo match. And we've seen that from him throughout his career, but certainly the last couple of years, and now especially, and this is the conversation I've had with most of the people here. Once Rafa went out, and the way Rafa obviously has looked in the last 2 years, injury-wise and health-wise and inability to stay on the court-wise, once all that went down and Novak got to 24, and he knew that Rafa was very much in his rear view and he wasn't going to get to 24 and he wasn't going to get over him at 25, and he knew that he had the Grand Slam record, he's got the weeks at number one record, he's got the year-end number one record, he's got the tour finals record, right? He's got every record possible, essentially. Almost, other than singles titles, which is probably, he's not going to catch Connors, but that's whatever. Like, all the important stuff, he's got that. At that point, what's his motivation now? His motivation is only slams. And that's why I still felt good about his level of play. But yeah, the injury thing is probably where it loses me overall.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, he dug deep a couple times. He showed a lot of heart and a lot of grit. And if there's one thing that I think was missing from his season up until this point, it was resolve. It was fire emotionally. So the fact that he showed a whole lot of that, even if the level was a little bit up and down, for me was a big positive, a big kind of stock up development for Djokovic. But then when you're looking at the Olympics, okay, now he needs to come off injury. He's not going to have any momentum built up. It's impossible to spin that part of it as a positive. What about the scheduling aspect? Because I do think you had a unique perspective to this, especially with the 3 a.m. finish against Musetti, because you were on the air that night and you kind of got to see how the chips were falling in terms of the decisions being made by RG. John McEnroe was hammering the Roland Garros organizers before the match was going to go to 3 a.m. Like, Bergs and Dimitrov were like in a third set and Johnny Mack was already. Yeah, exactly.
Zizou got the entirety of that tirade. Like, Grigor almost got off scot-free. Zizou is just this guy who qualifies for Roland Garros and gets into the third round. And it's amazing and all that. And here he is, he's just getting crucified for this decision he has nothing to do with. But it was interesting. And Amélie Mauresmo had a really difficult decision on her hands, just plain and simple. And there was no correct answer. I mean, you've seen this, and I know you've talked about the layout and maybe how they could change the night session versus the day session and what differs from this night session versus like the US Open or other tournaments. And I agree with you. I think having one night match doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I think starting the night session at 8:22 also probably doesn't make sense. I think if you moved it up and did two and you could have one women's and one men's match, I think that's better for the ticket overall. So, but that's a separate issue. And obviously a lot of it comes down to money and how much money you can make and maximizing the funds you can bring in. I get all of that. With that being said, this one was interesting. So in hindsight, it stopped raining the rest of the day. Like, Taylor Fritz was playing on an outside court against Tanasi Kokkinakis, and they finished. You know, they went back on court and they finished the match. And anyone who watched that one saw some weird line calls and Allison Hughes getting out of the chair and Kokkinakis literally saying he was going to lose his mind. That was also hilarious. Not to mention, you probably saw Paul Anacone looking like he was in an igloo the entire time, the rest of that match. I texted Paul and I was like, are you feeling all right? He goes, it's bleeping winter out here, is what he said. Meanwhile, Michael Russell standing next to him, like, it's summer. It was just a great dichotomy of coaching. So in hindsight, if you knew it wasn't going to rain anymore, you weren't going to move anybody to Longland or Chatrier. But the double thing in hindsight is, why not move the Hurkacz match, which was in the third set, I believe, to Chatrier, and move Grigor and Zizou over to Longlin, which was in the first set? That was where I think they lost me. That was where I think they, even if they felt like there was still going to be rain, knowing that they had the night session, knowing that they had fans that bought tickets specifically for the one match, and knowing that they had fans that wanted to see the world number one and 24-time Grand Slam champion at a decent enough hour, you go with the match that's further along in progress. And I think that was probably the biggest mistake they made, because they had to get, basically the reason was they knew they had to get those two matches in because they were going to have to play the next day and the winners were going to have to play the next day. So they had to get them in simultaneously. Totally understand that. I just would have switched which ones you put where, personally.
Or if you knew it wasn't going to rain, and I don't know, maybe the radar was unclear, maybe that part was ambiguous, then you could have put them outside.
They couldn't put them outside because they felt like they had to finish, and it looked like it was going to start raining.
And okay.
At least here, and that would be my perspective on it, of why they didn't put them outside, was the radar did show a chance that it was going to start raining again, I think around 9 or something, somewhere in that area. So the likelihood was they were going to put them out there, they were going to have to bring them back in, and then they were going to have to figure it all out. And that would have been a...
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for clearing that part up. That's the kind of thing that when we're on our couches, we're not necessarily checking the Paris radar. And that's why, you know, when they were playing outside and it was clear, that was part of the reason it seemed so ridiculous that you wouldn't just put the match outside. But okay. Sure. That was definitely something that, because of how things played out, has gotten everybody talking. I want to move on to some of the more broadcasty stuff. First of all, we've talked about John and his unfiltered nature, and I'm just wondering if there was one moment on the air so far where you've been like, is he really going there? Like, is this happening right now?
Well, I would say there have been several. You know, John, the funny thing with John is that he basically was Charles Barkley before Charles Barkley existed. You know, he's the guy who is willing to say anything, who's willing to throw anybody under the bus, who's willing to just go any place, which I find to be extremely entertaining when done right. And I feel like, at least, and I might be biased because I'm working with him, but I feel like in this tournament, he has done it right. Now, the problem for us is that a lot of it is directed at Peacock. And that was what I was warned ahead of time, was like, hey, John is probably going to bag on Peacock a lot, so just be ready for it. And I was like, I'll be honest with you, I'll be ready to clean anything up, but you gotta let him go. You gotta let him get out what he wants to get out, because that's when he's at his best. And if you don't let him do it on that, then why are you gonna let him do it on something else? So is that the Zizou thing was I thought very funny, because again, this poor guy is like in the match of his life and just trying to fight, and he wins a set and John is just beside himself that this guy would even be on Chatrier, and to think someone named Zizou would ever be put on court Philippe Chatrier. What a disgrace to Roland Garros and all of that. So that was good. We have the different pronunciation on air. The Zybach field was definitely high on the list. He did ask about the live rankings at one point on air as well. I kept mentioning, oh, this person is going to be is here in the live rankings. And he said, when you say live rankings, what are you referring to? I said, well, I'm referring to, you know, what their ranking is going to be after the tournament, essentially. He goes, so is that 2024? I was like, well, no, it's over the last 52 weeks of the tennis season. And so then we got more into it. Now he's all in on live rankings. He didn't even know you could find these live rankings. So we add more to the arsenal, but he's been on pretty good behavior overall. And honestly, he's been in a great mental headspace. He did just win his Legends match. So he was happy about that. That always goes a long way. He's got another one coming up tomorrow, but he's been a pleasure to work with, honestly. And he's been a lot of fun, and he's willing to have fun, which for me and for you and for a lot of us, I think is a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to say much to this, but I'm just going to get my piece in. And, you know, we are not in the business of telling people who they should and shouldn't like on the air. Like, we're just not in the business, right? You're going to have your opinion, and that's totally fine. I mean, it's a subjective thing. What I will say is what John does as somebody who is an entertainer, a natural entertainer, and a natural funny man is really the best way to appreciate him. And that aspect of what he does is, quite frankly, unlike anyone who is calling tennis in the world. The entertainment aspect of it and the humor aspect of it, it's unmatched. So I just wanted to say that because I know that obviously because he's different, there are a lot of opinions out there, and that's mine.
Very well put, Gil. It's very, very well put. And like I said, again, I think just being around him, you do realize that mentally, like the mental chess of the game, he still is elite when you watch a match with him. When you're sitting next to him and really watching him watch a match, he still dissects the game at an incredibly, incredibly high level. And that's what stood out to me is just even conversations we'll have, like I said, in breaks, off air, whatever it might be, or when we're watching a match before we get on the air, or I'm watching him watch a match and just kind of how he is approaching it. It's been fascinating. So it's been really cool just to see that whole process as well.
He and Mary go way back, huh? I mean, that's a pretty unique situation. I don't know if there's anything like it, quite frankly, where these two New York kids grew up with each other, were around each other basically their whole lives. It's how many years later, and they're teammates.
It's hard to fathom because you just don't see it this much anymore. I mean, not just growing up together, they were three houses down from each other. They grew up three houses away. So picture your neighbor three houses down from you. One, picture winning a Grand Slam with that person at a teenage year. You know, in 1977, they win Roland Garros together. That in itself is already incredible. And then to be broadcast partners for as long as they have been, and to be for a long time the preeminent broadcast faces of tennis for a long, long time, is remarkable. And to still be doing it at the level they are. But for me, it was great because I walk into this and I can already just feel this chemistry that they have with one another, and inside jokes and people that they know, and going back to all of their childhood memories and growing up into high school, and for John his 1 year college and whatever else it might be, of they can just talk about that stuff at any moment. And it's like any of us seeing a neighbor that we haven't seen in a couple months or a couple years or whatever, you immediately just pick up right where you left off. And that's what they are. And they balance each other out really, really, really well. So it's been cool to just be a part of that and be welcomed into that club a little bit, just for the time being. But amazing, amazing, just staying power. And again, I think if you had told both of them at 9, 10, 11 years old what the future would have in store, I'm not sure they believe it.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And they're so comfortable with one another that it makes for great television. I'm going to stay on the broadcast thing. I was going to move on. But I'm just curious because obviously you call a lot of college football, you call a lot of NBA basketball, college basketball, and in those sports, you are calling the action, sometimes having to speak very fast, oftentimes having to raise your voice to a high volume. And these things are not as much part of calling tennis. And I think, you know, you and I have had these conversations, of course. I think the people would be curious to hear from your perspective, what are the challenges that tennis presents as a sport that is so different to broadcast compared to a lot of the other things you're doing?
Well, I think the first part is, again, going back to knowing your audience the right way. So again, especially when I was on Tennis Channel, I didn't want to come in and act like I did all this preparation and I learned about all these people and let me just let it all go out, because most of the people watching know all that stuff already, and they're going to basically be like, shut up, dude, I don't want to hear you. And I think I had to learn that the hard way. You know, I think when I first started, I did want to just let it rip and show how much I learned and show all of my knowledge on a player or both players or the tournament or whatever. And you just want to get all that information out. And what I realized is there's always a time and a place for it. And most of the time and the place is to never do it or never put it in. And I think it took me a little while to learn that and to really come to terms with the best tennis announcers are the ones that let the action lead them and let their analysts lead them more than anything. And especially when I have two analysts and one that certainly is opinionated and willing to say what's on his mind, or at Tennis Channel working with a bevy of different personalities, I think they'll know the game better than I ever could dream of. And they'll see the game better than I could ever dream of. And so remembering that is always important. And then to your point, you know, I wasn't just doing, especially when I started, I wasn't just doing the college football and NBA on TV. I was doing the Clippers on radio alone. So I was going from different ends of the spectrum of literally having to say everything and describe every single thing that I was seeing in front of me. And then I would go to Tennis Channel and I would sit in the chair and I'd be like, okay, I feel like I need to talk more. Like, I feel like you need to talk more. And then I would go back and watch or listen to a broadcast of like, I was talking too much. Just shut up and let that happen. Let the crowd showcase, let this happen, let whatever. The other thing I had to learn was one of the early lessons that I had been taught, and I think you subscribe to this and great broadcasters all do, is the final call of a broadcast is a highlight because it gets played over again, right? You know, most people don't think of it that way. Most people think of the highlights as the highlights, and then they just kind of do the final end of it, and they don't really put that much thought to it. But tennis, you certainly have to put thought to it because that is the highlight most of the time that people will see and hear and remember. But what I was doing early was I was always taught you want to be on top of the action. You don't want to be behind the action. You want to make sure you are directly saying something when it happens. And after a tennis match, what do you hear first immediately is the chair umpire. And you go back to a lot of my final calls and I'm battling with the chair umpire. And then you're trying to figure out who do I listen to. So I finally have realized, okay, let the chair umpire finish what they have to say. And now you can get in cleanly and do it the right way. And you can make sure you put a bow on it and you don't have to overdo it and get in and get out. Be as concise as you possibly can. So yeah, it's been a lot of lessons, I think, in tennis. I also think that the environment dictates how much you should talk. So Coco and Iga, crowd is completely in it. It's a full packed house. Same with Rafa and Zverev. Packed house, not a single seat empty. Crowd's on their feet. Rafa has a huge point. He converts on a break point. Crowd's going nuts. I don't need to say anything at that point. Anything that I will say is going to take away from that crowd. Anything that I will say will take away from that environment. Same with when Coco broke today. If I'm going to say something, why would I say anything to take away from that environment? Now, we called it a little bit after the fact, so it was a little different. But if we're doing it live, we're laying out entirely. And the same will go for if the final or these semifinals have amazing atmospheres, that'll do the work. But you also have to recognize when a match doesn't. And we did a lot of matches that were on side courts that don't have a lot of spectators, and you can lay out, but what's there? There's only so much to lay out to for those. So I think also recognizing when the right time to kind of get all that information you did prepare is, and when the right time to just kind of shut up and let the pictures do a lot of the talking is, which is the majority of the time.
Yeah, that was a terrific rundown. Definitely stuff that
this episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Ready to pop the question and take advantage of 30% off? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com to get 30% off select lab-grown diamonds. That's BlueNile.com for 30% off lab-grown diamonds. BlueNile.com.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
That I've kind of, it's a learning curve, you know, and I think it's similar lessons for a lot of different people. I talked about this on air, so some people might remember, but when Nuno Borges won the Phoenix Challenger, the roar that he let out was at a volume that is incomprehensible. Like, I don't know how somebody yells that loud. And I was, yeah, I mean, I was about to go and start my call. It would have been a disaster, but the chair umpire layout saved me. I mean, nobody would have heard what I said if I started talking. So that was one of those examples that I was like, aha, avoided disaster there. It's funny. You talked about the delay and you called Coco and Iga on delay because you had the time slot to fill on NBC. I was talking with someone who has been a part of the ATP tour for 20 years as one of, you know, the traveling members on the business end. And he said that it was a big complication for tennis that you don't know how long the matches are going to go and that it's difficult to program tennis on network TV because of that fact. As right. Someone who is living that, I want to bounce that off of you. And by the way, the US Open is going to air on ABC. So another network will have tennis. And obviously, for those who don't know, especially for the international audience, ABC, NBC, Fox, and am I missing the fourth here? CBS, sorry. and CBS they have the largest audiences because the most households get those stations. So like, what are the complications there that need to be dealt with?
I'm not really sure if there is a right answer, because to your point, I mean, let's just use that Novak match as a perfect example, right? Rain takes out the play from around the outside courts. If it's a weekday, which I think that was a weekend, so it's a little bit different. I want to say that was a Saturday. But if it was, let's say it's a Friday or a Thursday, like these semifinals are, Thursday or Friday, well, NBC has programming that needs to get on their normal Monday through Friday schedule, namely the Today Show. And there's a lot of money that goes into the Today Show. There's a lot of sponsorship and ad revenue that comes through the Today Show. And so to give that up would require them to be willing to part with however many millions of dollars it generates. So I understand why you have to have the certain slot, which is what we did. And so we couldn't knock off the entire thing. So I think we came on at 11 a.m. Eastern, somewhere in that range. At the same time, the tournament, because of the 6-hour time difference, they're not going to schedule both matches to be played at night, because let's say they have the walkouts at 5:02 local. So that's 11:02 Eastern, 8:02 Pacific, which we could talk about that all together. But let's just say they did that at 5:02. They had walkouts for the first match. And all three sets go to breakers. So now you've got a three-hour match. So now it's 8:30 by the time the second one comes on. And you've got two tickets. It's possible, don't get me wrong, but the whole point of having this is that it's supposed to be in the day. You know, it's part of the Grand Slam aspect of it. And having these matches at night isn't necessarily entirely fair to the players and isn't what the players want, which I totally understand. So it's hard with the programming aspect of it, combined with the fact of NBC would then have to block out a window that would allow for potentially 6 hours worth of tennis just for the women's and maybe 8 hours worth of tennis for two men's matches. And that's a lot of programming. It's a lot of program that you would have to then sell sponsorship for and make the ad revenue of whatever it's knocking off versus NBA game, NFL game, college football game, MLB game. You know exactly how long or just about how long those are going to go. And sure, you've got your crazy ones like our Syracuse Orange against UConn in 2009, the Big East tournament going to six overtimes, you know? So yeah, it knocks off other programming. That's okay. Because guess what? When you have a crazy game or match or something of that nature, everyone's going to start tuning in anyway. So you're going to get a ton of eyeballs. So that's totally okay. But you can't, if you can't plan accordingly, you know, for example, today we had a 3 hour time window and the second final went 90 minutes. So now we have 90 minutes that we need to fill. And so why do we go back and call the Coco match? Well, for those who missed it or didn't get to see it live or hadn't been on Tennis Channel, now you get to see how it happens. Now you get to see how Coco lost, how Iga won, how this, how that, what was the crowd like? You get to see it, and we'll be here to provide any context. But it's difficult. And so I'm not really sure what the right answer is. I know that NBC has the Peacock side of it, and I'm sure there are plenty of people that would love to chat way, way more about Peacock and ESPN Plus and Tennis Channel Plus and all the streaming aspects of the sport and sports in general. But I will say that's here to stay, and that's probably the best solution to it is having matches start there and then eventually making their way on to the network television. Because to your point, if our goal is just making money, then that's one thing. But if our goal is what it should be, and that is growing the game and making sure that the most amount of people see the sport and see these stars that are in the making, the network television is by far the best place to put it, because that's where you are guaranteed to get the most eyeballs. And the numbers there just don't lie. I mean, it's millions and millions and millions of people of difference between those two. So I'm not sure there's a correct answer. I just know that the more tennis that can be on network television is probably the best thing for the sport itself.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, I think the reason why this is so important to bring up is because people do look at a little bit of an inconsistency in terms of the media rights money that comes into other sports and the media rights money that comes into tennis. And given the fact that tennis is, by a lot of metrics, the third most popular sport in the world, like it's up there. A lot of people care a lot about it. It's how does this not add up? Why is the media money not equaling the popularity? This is one thing to think about as a possible reason, is because it's harder to program. And that's what the person at the ATP, you know, that's what we were talking about. So it's good to get your take on that. I want to end on your tennis content kick. I'm very intrigued. I've been restraining myself from asking you about this so that we could do it on air. But I know basketball season ended and you had a little bit of time to look forward to Roland Garros and you wanted to get in that tennis state of mind. So maybe you picked up a couple books and you looked at a couple things. What stuck with you from some of the stuff that you consumed to get into that RG state of mind?
Yeah. So to just, I guess, be completely upfront about what I had been doing, I love to read. And especially in my off season, quote unquote, I'll read a ton. I mean, as much as I possibly can. I love doing it. So when I finished up, or actually towards the end of my NBA season, my dad had always told me how much he loved Agassi's book. And I was always a tennis guy growing up. Obviously, I'd been working with Tennis Channel now the last 5 years. I felt like, why haven't I read this yet? So So I pick it up, and like everybody who has listened here that has read the book, couldn't put it down, finished it in a blink. You know, it was riveting from the start. But I think I really loved, and we talked about this, but I think I really loved just getting inside the mind of a player, and especially a player like him that hated tennis, that did it because he was incredible at it. And then towards the end of his career and later in life, realized maybe he didn't hate tennis. Maybe it was really good for him. Maybe it was exactly where he was supposed to be. But also hearing how he handled every matchup, hearing how he handled his rivalry with Sampras, hearing how he handled going to different tournaments and what gave him angst and what brought him solace and dealing with Brad versus Darren and like all of that stuff I found fascinating. And so I'm like, I got to read more. So I bought Rafa's book, which I still can't believe he wrote when he was like, I don't know what, 24, 25. No,
that's the only evidence that he might've believed the doctors telling him and the media.
That's
members,
what I'm saying.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. Like the first sentences in the book are basically how incredibly hard it is to be a professional athlete and how the body takes such a toll that you can never recover from. And I'm like, when did he write this? And I had to look back and it was 2011 or something like that. And I'm thinking, why didn't he wait? Why didn't he try? But you're right. It's 100%. As you read it, you're like, wow, this is fascinating. But anyway, I found that fascinating. I was always a huge Rafa Nadal fan, as you know. And so to get inside his head and get inside his process was amazing. I knew I was going to be working with McEnroe. So I read his book, which I loved every second of. And I loved his own perspective on things. And I fell so much in love with that I bought this other one that was basically went in depth about all of the players of his era. So Borg, McEnroe, Connors, Garolaitis, all of them, you know, basically a little bit on Lendl, you know, a little bit Becker, others, but it was amazing. And it was amazing to hear the difference because those guys were really the first. Obviously you had Ash and you had Laver and guys of that stature. But those guys weren't making the money that McEnroe and his generation started to. They weren't the celebrities that they started to because they were the real first professionals. And so to hear that of like how they handled that and how the relationships went and how they had to deal with each other and how they went out and were on the town together, I thought that was awesome. And so I watched a bunch of other stuff. I went back and watched a bunch of old matches. I love to consume stuff. I mean, that's what happens any seasons I'm in. So, right, I think I'm a little more than halfway through now because I'm doing the Olympic basketball. I'm reading a book on the Dream Team right now. This is just, I guess, my own process for whatever it's worth of how I go from season to season. So, for example, before my football season last year, I went back. You can find the extended highlights of every Super Bowl basically ever. So it's a 15-minute cut of the Super Bowl on YouTube. And I went back and I watched the last, I think, 15 or 16 Super Bowls before my football season started. The 15-minute cuts of all of them. Just because I wanted to hear how different they were all called for me. Like I wanted to hear the broadcast side of it. So I did the same for tennis. I went back and watched a lot and heard the differences of how they were called and how they were handled and how different moments were handled. Because I wanted to hear that. And what else have I done with sports? Oh, then I did the same with the NBA and with college basketball and, you know, college basketball. I read Coach K's book, same type of thing. So I don't know. I guess that's just kind of how it's my own process of how to do things. But I loved all the tennis stuff. I still have to read String Theory, which I do have ready to go. And then whatever else. I know that you were reading Winning Ugly. Did you finish, by the way?
No, I was reading Inner Game.
Oh, Inner Game.
Yeah.
Did you ever read Winning Ugly?
I did. It was a long time ago. So I'd love to reread it. There's still stuff. I was really super young when I read that. And there's still stuff I remember. Beware the Wounded Bear with the, you know, when you have an injured opponent, like don't relax. He made a pretty compelling argument that if you win the toss, the coin flip, you should elect to receive.
Hmm.
And that stuck with me. I'm pretty sure my entire childhood.
I really do wonder though, because obviously that was, and anybody who watched today, I did ask John if Brad was the most frustrating player he had to play against. And his response was, I did pretty well against him, but the one time I ever lost to him, I stepped away from the game for 6 months. So that should tell you about all you need to know. So, okay, fair. But I do wonder if Brad's philosophy on that would have changed if he knew how guys serve nowadays.
Quite possibly. With the scoreboard pressure aspect of it now.
If he knew that Sasha Zverev is standing on the other side of the net or Hubie Hurkacz is standing at the other side of the net, would he still feel that way? Or maybe I'm sure that what the argument is basically guys get tight to start a match, or there's something of starting a match or whatever it might be.
Warming up the body, like the serve uses every muscle in the body. So if you're only 80% warm, you'd much rather start serving when you're 100% warm after you've played 6 points, I think is kind of partially how it went.
That's a pretty good argument. All that to say, I will be consuming more at some point, but that's been my kick right now. And I really hope that Rafa does a part two, because I think it's kind of BS that we only get half of it. And basically, you know, there's small mention of Novak Djokovic in it.
True. Although a glowingly positive mention of Djokovic as a player, like they knew very early on before Novak was dominating, they were like, this guy's a problem.
Yeah, no, if you go back and read it, or even just read the excerpts about Djokovic, they literally are basically foreshadowing what's going to happen. They're like, this guy, he says, you know, I know how to beat him now, but he is coming for me, essentially, which is vintage Rafa. Like, he's just the humility and all of it, the honesty, whatever else he might do. But I will be watching the new Federer documentary when it comes out. I know I saw the preview for it. Which was funny because, and this is going to be a not so humble brag by me, which I apologize to all of you for, but NBC, when they announced the Olympic stuff for me, they said, hey, we want you to do some press stuff. I go, yeah, no problem, whatever you need. They go, we want you to go on Access Hollywood. I was like, wow, that's really cool. I love that show, all good. So I get there and they're treating me like, oh my God, this is amazing that you're here. And here's your green room and we're going to escort you downstairs. And I'm like, this is awesome. Like, here I am, $8. And I get down there. They're like, all right, just sit right here and your segment's up next. And I'm like, cool. And then they come up to me and they go, hey, do you mind waiting? We had to move a segment up. Are you okay if you wait like 20, maybe 30 minutes? I'm like, oh yeah, like that's fine. I just figured that they had a scheduling conflict, and literally I look up and in walks Roger Federer, and I'm like, oh, I felt so good. I'm like, wow, they're really treating me like royalty. And then a 20-time Grand Slam champion walks in. They're like, yeah, by the way, we don't care about you. Sit off to the side.
Yeah. I mean, so you started as you thought you were the A block, and then really it didn't play out that way fully, but you know.
Oh yeah.
It also, you know, when it's Federer, you also accept it. Of course, I'll tell you. Inner Game just hit its 40th anniversary, and I got an email about that. So it's been around a long time, and my recommendation for that is it applies to all aspects of life. Like, it's just a performance book. It's not everything is in the construct of tennis, but everything in that entire book applies outside of tennis. So I just felt I wanted to plug it, 40th anniversary. So that's a good one. That should go on your list.
No, I like it, man. And you're obviously now blasting all the content my way, which has been appreciated into my inbox. For all those who haven't subscribed already, please do. But I'm glad you're getting Wertheim's excellence in there, because he's had some good ones and you're making sure that the people are seeing them, which is cool. And he was great. He's always great to be around, and he's always very proud of those pieces. So check those out as well. Those are great.
Yeah. 100%. Noah, appreciate this so much. I will obviously let you get to bed and get to prepping or whatever you're doing next. Good luck on tomorrow and the finals over the weekend. And I will continue to be enjoying it and hope everybody watching does as well, and now knows a lot more about you as a tennis person, which is great.
I will finish this one the way that we started our first Monday Match Analysis. Gillen, thank you very much for having me.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.